Your name?
Cynthia Poles.
Cynthia Poles, you testified earlier at a public oversight roundtable on rent control in the District of Columbia before Michael Brown, the chairperson for the Committee on Housing and Workforce Development. What is rent control?
Rent control is a D.C. law that regulates the rents paid by not all tenants, but tenants who live in buildings that were built prior to 1976. And it has a bunch of loopholes in it, so it's not really a strict price regulation in the pure sense, but it does provide some baseline protections.
What do you hope happen? Rent control is 5 years, and it's up in the District of Columbia, and very soon, if it's not renewed, it will disappear?
The law as currently written expires on December 31st of this year, and it would automatically expire by its own terms, and there would be no law regulating rents if the D.C. Council fails to act in some way. So that's why we're grateful that Chairman Brown and Councilmember Graham have rallied the rest of the council to unanimously support extension of law for at least 10 years and perhaps to even make it permanent. So that's a very good first step from the tenant's perspective in this battle.
Cynthia Poles, in your testimony, you pointed out that it's not enough simply to extend rent control. There are ways that it can be improved upon.
There are many ways in which it can be improved upon. Right now, the law allows the landlords to increase rents by the CPI every single year.
Can you explain what the CPI is?
The CPI is the Consumer Price Index. That's essentially an indicator that the Department of Labor assembles that measures the rate of inflation in a broad geographic area. And the last one was 4.8% because inflation was fairly high. The most current one is 0.05%, so that's more reasonable. But the law also allows the landlords to tack an additional 2% onto that Consumer Price Index. So in this past year where we had 4.8 CPI, it ended up being a 6.8% rent increase for the vast majority of tenants, which was a pretty heavy hit in difficult financial times that people in earlier this year and in late 2009, they were experiencing 6.8% increases in their rent under rent control. So that's part of what our endeavor here is, to get that 2% taken off. So we're not basically compounding the effects of inflation on tenants every single year, and eventually, if you follow math to its logical end, when you add the 2%, the prices compound and compound, so that eventually you would be well above the market rents for rent control. So that 2% really needs to be eliminated to preserve genuine rent control.
Cynthia Poles, also testifying today were representatives of the landlords. Do they see it as you see it?
No, it's clear that they're concerned about the permanent law. They like to keep us on the 5-year renewals because that gives them a shot at it every 5 years and keeps us on tenterhooks. I would say they want the smaller buildings to be exempt from rent control. That would be devastating for a lot of people because there's people that live in those buildings and have lived there for a very long time under rent control. So to suddenly say, because these so-called small housing providers are here bleeding away to the council, that you suddenly take them off the rolls for rent control, that would be a real serious problem for the tenants of the District of Columbia.
Cynthia Poles, can you talk about? Let me read just a line from your written testimony. Fixing the district's rent control laws is essential for the district's future. It is one of the few tools the district government has to preserve and enhance the racially, ethnically, and economically diverse character of the city. Can you explain that?
Essentially, your longstanding population, much of it African American, lives largely in rental properties. Same is true for the Latino population. They're largely renters. So to the extent you erode and remove the protections they have from rent control, you ultimately make the places they live unaffordable, and they have no choice but to depart the city. So you get a whiter city in the end, and you get a richer city. And some of us wonder if, you know, some of the decision makers wouldn't prefer that it be that way. They're not ever going to state that because that's not the kind of thing you want your constituents to know, that you want their kind to leave the city. But, you know, that may be that a lot of the decision makers would prefer that some of these things that preserve a very solid stock of rental housing, as we have here, we have 55% or so of the city living in rental housing. That's fairly unique in the country, that there are that many renters here. So to the extent you start doing away with the legal framework that keeps that housing stock, that rental housing stock in place, you change the city. You change the city, and if you're going to do that, you should be upfront about it and say we want a different city, as opposed to just sub rosa, you know, pulling protections out here and there, so that suddenly we have a different city, and we never decided we were going to have a different city. So I think that's what's going on.
One of the ways landlords are maybe somewhat sneakily raising rents is through something called a hardship petition. Mm-hmm. I don't think many people have heard about this, or that landlords are guaranteed 12% return on their investment. That is shocking.
It is indeed shocking, and actually it tells you how much money they're making, that not too many of them invoke the hardship petition. Obviously, they're making way more than 12%. You know, they tend to make 50 or 60% on their equity in most cases. But some of them, these so-called small housing providers, are ones who were financially irresponsible, and they basically took money out of their buildings at the peak of the market. They borrowed against the building, not to improve the building, but just to take money out, as you can when you have an asset. So now they're leveraged. They can't afford to pay their mortgages. So those are the kind of providers that end up filing these hardship petitions, which can be absolutely devastating, because not only do they guarantee the 12%, but there's no outside limit on what the rent increases should be to produce the 12%. So if they can dummy up some numbers that show that they're bleeding, then they have, in cases, been allowed to increase their rents by 100%. So it's kind of like a ridiculous loophole in the law that, you know, one, that provision exists, and two, that the rate of return is so high. You know, regulated utilities don't get that kind of rate of return. Like a Pepco gets 8%, or Washington Gas gets 8%. That's your more typical arrangement when you have a price regulation. That's the kind of rate of return you're entitled to, not 12%.
How did that come to be, a guaranteed 12% return on landlords' investment?
It's apparently gone up over time. It used to be 8%, and at some point in time it was lifted to 12%. I don't know the exact details, but there's a constitutional argument that the landlords have, and any entity has, when there's price regulation, which is the takings clause of the Constitution, that you cannot have rules that prohibit you from gaining any kind of return on your property. So having an outlet like a hardship petition is okay within much stricter limits than we currently have.
What is substantial rehabilitation?
That is a petition that a landlord can file to basically completely reconstruct the innards of a building and the exterior. In a very wide-ranging way, such that the tenants usually have to move out while the construction goes on. And it's like the hardship petition. They submit the paperwork. They establish that there's a need to do these renovations. And if their paperwork is convincing to one of these judges in the Office of Administrative Hearings, then he will basically rubber stamp a rent increase, which can go up to 125%. That's the statutory cap. And as I talked about in my testimony, there's a building up the street from me where they approved 64% rent increase. Well, that's in order to move out, because, you know, not very many people are living in a building where they have cash set aside to suddenly pay that kind of a rent increase. If they had that kind of money, they'd live elsewhere, you know. And I don't know, this particular building has been devastating to them, that it's a nice old building where people have lived there for a very long time, and they used to have a very benign landlord who lived in the building, and he died, and the building migrated into more aggressive profit-making hands. And so this is what happens. You know, the legal proceedings get pushed to the maximum to get a return. That's still in litigation, I believe, but that is where things stand right now, that basically they could not, the tenants could not rally the experts. They couldn't pay for the expert witnesses to refute the claims that the landlord could substantiate through his expert witnesses. So they thought they were the experts in the building, which of course they are, you know, since they live there. But he didn't care, the judge didn't care. He just said, well, the other guys had experts, you didn't, so I'm going with their experts. And so basically he took most of their numbers.
Is there a disparity between the legal representation that landlords can afford and that which tenants can afford?
Yes, because in most cases, if you're a tenant, you're talking about, if you have a dispute with your landlord, you're talking, as an individual might be talking about, a rather small amount of money. Maybe I'm overcharged $100 a month or even $200 a month. Even if I have resources, it doesn't really make sense for me to go out and hire an attorney and pay them $10,000 to properly represent me in a dispute over $100 a month. So what happens, and in most cases, of course, tenants don't have the resources, they go into these proceedings on their own and represent themselves, and the landlord shows up with someone from the Greenstein, Delorme, and Lux law firm, and you're suddenly in like full-blown court proceeding with these guys where demanding that you authenticate your documents and that kind of thing, and they're just immediately they're outgunned. It's an unfair process to send a tenant up against a deep pocket law firm. That's what happens.
Another way that landlords are able to jack up rents is when there's a vacancy, mm-hmm. and in a city where there's so many students, this happens quite a lot. Can you talk about this issue?
I've actually watched it in my building evolve over time as the rents on the vacant units have moved up so high. You know, they're essentially unconstrained, in effect, by the way the law works. So the landlord can pretty much go for the market rent. So even though there's rent control in theory, the price that they pay is not what we would think a regulated price should be. So what has happened over time is apartments that used to be occupied by a single person or a couple, they're now occupied by, in my building we have a fairly large unit, so you get three unrelated young professionals joining economic forces to rent an apartment together so that they can afford it. But then you build in an inherent instability in your renter population, because these groups of three cannot really stay together very long. So they're turning over within the units. One person will move out, another person will move in. So it's very much changed the character of a lot of buildings. And I see this in my own building, and talking to tenants around the city, it is absolutely typical that you have either groups of young professionals, or in the buildings that are closer to the universities, you get students, four or five students joining together and renting an apartment together. So it's a different renter's population when you head in that direction from what we're historically used to, which is a more stable, sort of family-oriented population.
Cynthia Poles, any final thoughts you want to share as we sit out here outside the council chamber? You just testified on rent control before the Committee on Housing and Workforce Development.
Just that we're encouraged by the leadership that council members Michael Brown and Jim Graham are showing on the issue, and we're hopeful that they'll take a comprehensive look at the laws and start to tighten some of these many loopholes so that we'll eliminate the extra 2%, so we'll get at least start moving towards a better set of laws that will help constrain the galloping prices for renting housing in the district and ensure that people can continue to live on in the city as renters for the foreseeable future, and the character of the city will be preserved.
Thanks so much.
Okay. No problem. Thank you.